Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the looming possibility of a Russian invasion of eastern Ukraine as tanks, artillery and troops mass on the Russian side of the border. Robert English, a professor of international relations at USC, who has an article in the Los Angeles Times, Ukraine's Threat from Within, Neo-Fascists Are as Much a Menace to Ukraine as Putin's Actions in Crimea, joins us. We'll discuss how the presence of extreme right-wing elements in the new Ukrainian government are playing into Putin's propaganda, like waving a red flag in front of a nervous bull, and that the US and the EU should denounce these elements and seek compromise with Russia. Then we'll look into the continuing street battles and demonstrations in Venezuela, in which both student protesters and National Guardsmen have been killed. David Smaldi, a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, who has researched Venezuela for the last 20 years and lived there for 10 years, joins us from Caracas to provide an update on this increasingly polarized confrontation between a government supported by the majority who are poor and the country's middle class who are fed up and frustrated by shortages of basic commodities, soaring inflation, and rampant crime. Then finally, we will speak with Dr. Mansour El-Kahia, who is a Libyan-American scholar, columnist, activist, and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Texas, San Antonio. We will discuss the Libyan parliament's dismissal of the country's prime minister for failing to stop a North Korean tanker loaded with oil from a rebel-controlled terminal from escaping to sea, and the growing divisions between the lawless tribal west of the country and the separatist east, now in control of a number of oil terminals, but divided between secular rebels and Islamist militants. And joining us now is Robert English, who's a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California, who studies Russia, the former USSR, and Eastern Europe, and formerly worked as a policy analyst for the U.S. Department of Defense and the Committee for National Security. He is currently working on a study entitled Our Serbian Brethren, History, Myth, and the Politics of Russian National Identity, and he has an article in the Los Angeles Times, Ukraine's Threat from Within, Neo-Fascists Are as Much a Menace to Ukraine as Putin's Actions in Crimea. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert English.
Thank you.
And of course, speaking of Putin's actions in Crimea, we don't know whether the Russian military is poised on the Ukrainian border, and it could in fact move in to eastern Ukraine. And the referendum, of course, takes place in a couple of days. And as a referendum, then in fact, there's no way you can vote no. you have two choices. One of which is to vote for a Russian annexation, and the other one is to vote for a 1991 compact that does the same thing.
I'm hoping that however the vote goes, and presumably it will be strongly in favor of joining Russia, that will serve mainly to give Putin stronger cards, but not to foreclose a compromise. In other words, that he doesn't have to go ahead and begin a process of outright annexation, but simply has a stronger hand, more leverage in this wrangling with the West and with the new Ukrainian government. And I think most sensible people see a compromise, which would be greater autonomy for Crimea within a sovereign Ukraine, and other protections and guarantees for the rights, cultural, linguistic, and so forth, of the large Russian population in Ukraine.
Well, but what explains this maneuver on the border? It's either ramping up pressure or it's the precursor for the real thing.
What explains it is the same thing that explains our and NATO's essentially similar actions, maneuvers, patrols, flights near the Russian border from some of the Baltic, Poland, those NATO countries. Both sides are kind of saber-rattling. And again, it would be a tragedy of unbelievable proportions if fighting really breaks out. But I'm hoping instead both sides can rattle their sabers and try to strengthen their hands, but then pull back from the brink and find a compromise along the lines of what I just described.
Well, I thought what you wrote in your op-ed in the Los Angeles Times, Ukraine's Threat from Within, Neo-Fascists Are as Much a Menace to Ukraine as Putin's Actions in Crimea, that you pointed out here, just quoting your article, given our own hypocrisy, don't violate agreements except the ones to expand NATO eastward, don't invade countries on phony pretexts except Iraq, and don't support minority secession movements except Kosovo. So we, of course, our credibility is not great. And most of the mail I get criticizing my reporting on this is basically saying that the Ukrainian government are a bunch of fascists, which is what Putin is saying. But it's a little more nuanced than that, surely. And your argument in your article basically is, why wave a red flag in front of a nervous bull? But that leads you to ask the question, you know, with the new Prime Minister Yatsenyuk, who was just at the White House, who's Jewish, at the head of this government, why let all of these right-wing people in and take important cabinet posts? Is there any way that they can clean up their act and purge these people so that they don't give Putin the excuse that he may use, which is, you know, to invade Ukraine?
Yeah, there's a lot of complexities there. One is that, of course, Putin and the kind of propaganda, it really is propaganda coming out of Moscow and locally in Crimea, is really overheated in portraying a kind of immediate threat to life and limb for the Russian population there. That's not true. That's not real. And unfortunately, because it's so over the top, it's led many in the West, unfortunately, including some of our diplomatic officials, to dismiss any Russian concerns out of hand, when in fact, the point of my article is that there are real concerns, not some kind of paramilitary attacks, killing of Russians tomorrow, but the complexion of the Ukrainian government going forward, which, as you know, as I noted, is so strongly overrepresenting the far right and the extreme Ukrainian nationalists, the Svoboda Party, which is not the only such organization, but the most prominent, the best known, has five key positions in the new government. And essentially it has seven or eight because it has some former members, some founding members, including now in this right sector paramilitary group in the government as well. So if we say that the extreme nationalists have seven or eight key positions, that's 2 to 3 times what their electoral results, right? The last parliamentary elections in 2012 when they got about 10%. They're way overrepresented in this government, so that's sort of a concern right there. And, of course, they've been explicit over almost 2 decades with a strongly xenophobic, anti-Russian, anti-Semitic platform and ideology that's just truly odious. So that they're so powerful in this new government, even if they haven't taken any concrete actions yet, is an enormous concern.
So what explains, the fact that John McCain stood next to the founder of Svoboda, who is an anti-Semite? He's not in the parliament, but he's an unsavory character. And, of course, the Assistant Secretary of State, Victoria Nuland, has also rubbed shoulders with these people. She's a neocon left over. She worked for Dick Cheney. It's astounding to me that after what the neocons wrought in Iraq, that she'd be in Obama's government. Do you have any understanding of that?
As best I can tell, neither Nuland nor McCain meant to explicitly endorse these really repugnant right-wing characters. They were simply caught up in the photo opportunity and the excitement of being there in the mass protests and weren't very careful about whom they associated with, whom they posed for pictures with. They were very sloppy. I don't suspect that either one is anti-Semitic or is directly supporting this kind of new government. But they did it nonetheless. It was from the point of view of diplomatic protocol and what U.S. officials abroad ought to be doing and not be doing. It was a flagrant violation of both their Senate and diplomatic roles. We don't take sides. We don't associate with bad guys, but they did. And so the main effect is this sort of tacit endorsement that the U.S., again, this is how it's seen on the Russian side, which is understandably a little nervous, if not outright paranoid. We ought to have been a lot more careful. And having done that, my argument is that we should make sure we distance ourselves from this kind of ideology, from this kind of political force, and we haven't.
So, Robert English, what explains this imbalance in this new government with an over-representation from these right-wing thugs, anti-Semites, and, you know, neo-Nazis? Here I am, I'm sounding like Putin, but these are the facts. That's the true complexion of these people. Is it somewhat like what happened in Tahrir Square where the liberals initially started the revolution, the Muslim Brotherhood, the more ideological people stayed out and then came in later and added weight and also firepower to some extent.
It is something like that. But then there's an element, kind of revolutionary fervor, the chaos, the enthusiasm and passions of the moment. There's no doubt that the foot soldiers of some of these groups were brave and defended the protesters and did good things as well. So part of that is, again, just the, as you say, you could compare it to some other revolutionary upheavals. However, they didn't stop there. And with their firepower, we could say, their armed paramilitaries and those who even threw firebombs at the Ukrainian police, they have exerted and continue to exert a kind of really undue pressure on Ukrainian authorities and those who chose the composition of the new government. They also, as we know, pushed hard to force the moderate Ukrainian leaders to back out of that earlier agreement that would have eased the transition of Yanukovych from office. There was a compromise agreement all sides had supported until these hardline far-right forces came in and said, no, Yanukovych has to go now. And arguably that led to a lot of unnecessary bloodshed. That same kind of pressure continues to be exerted. And I don't think that, as I said, the Ukrainian moderates who formed and now make up a good part of this new government feel that they can operate without constantly looking over their right shoulder, if you will, at the passions of the crowd. And that's how they got more portfolios than they deserve in the new government. And that's how they continue to pressure both the parliament and this temporary government in their kind of far-right nationalist direction.
Well, they were also, the Svoboda people in the new government were responsible for pushing for a parliamentary vote that downgraded the Russian language, and which, of course, was an unpopular edict from Yanukovych, but that was subsequently revoked or repealed, I guess. But that has had tremendous consequences because, again, people who defend Putin's actions keep citing that as an example, the Russian language issue.
I mean, Ukrainian moderates left to their own devices, if they weren't under this kind of undue pressure, some of it explicitly physical pressure, without that, they would never have been so foolish as to make one of their very first moves in office in this divided country with the Russian population so nervous. Nevertheless, their first move is to pass in a majority of the parliament what was perceived correctly as a very anti-Russian move, even if it was more symbolic than real, because there's no immediate threat to the status of the Russian language in Crimea. It showed the intentions of this government going forward, what might happen over the long run. And again, as you point out, it showed this undue influence of the far right. It was a red flag in front of a bull.
Well, as you point out in your article in the Los Angeles Times, Robert English, Ukraine's menace from within, since the Soviet Union's collapse, millions of ethnic Russians or Russian speakers have endured loss of citizenship in the Baltic republics and been driven out of Central Asian jobs and homes and have suffered particularly virulent discrimination in Georgia, which in many ways was a root cause for the 2008 war. What's happening now in Russia is polls indicate that Putin is riding higher than ever. He's about 70% approval. Uh-huh. You know, you can imagine what an American politician would, how they'd feel about that. It's almost unheard of. And the Russian people are whipped up with all this propaganda. They're feeling very macho. They're feeling decades of humiliation have suddenly been lifted from them. But there's a whole element to this which I'm sort of trying to figure out for myself, and I'd like to get your opinion on. I'm not sure how much this is driven by geopolitics and by Russia's military concerns about NATO expansion eastward, since that's not on the table, or how much this is, whole thing is being driven by the new Tsar, the absolute power in Russia, Vladimir Putin, who saw his puppet, if you will, Yanukovych, run out of town, and his kleptocratic and tacky wealth exposed to the world with these vast palaces. My understanding is that Putin has even more palaces and even more money stashed abroad, and that I'm wondering how personal this is, that, you know, Putin, let's face it, this whole maneuver has restored his political luster. He's changed the subject from any possibility of looking into his excessive power and excessive kleptocratic activities. So it's all working out for him at this point, up until the point where blood is shed and then the whole thing could blow up. So give me a sense of what you think. How much of it is geopolitical or how much of it is personal?
Wow, there was a lot included in what you just said. Let me try to pull out three strands to comment on. The first is, of course, it's geopolitical as well. It always is. Putin wants to and is expanding his influence, his hegemony, or at least his soft dominance of former Soviet republics. But he and many Russians see that as pushing back, not pushing forward, but pushing back against the expansion of American and the American-led NATO alliance's influence in his former backyard. And they do have a point. None of us, Americans, British, whatever we might be, could look kindly just serenely on adversary alliance continually adding new members and pushing up to our borders. And as you said, that Ukraine's membership in NATO is off the table, but for how long? Right? Russia doesn't see that as any kind of permanent guarantee. And NATO taking over their bases in Ukraine, NATO right into the heart of the traditional Russian and Slavic sphere of influence, just terrifies them. So yes, it's about geopolitics on both sides. But let me go back to what you began with in your last comment, and that is Russians' feeling of victimization. And this is something we overlook at our peril. And again, it's easy to overlook it because Putin has been so over the top with his propaganda and his threat mongering. Even though there are threats there, he's made them so ridiculous that nobody believes him. We have to understand that Russians have suffered an enormous amount, and the things that I pointed out that you cited are very often forgotten. Millions of Russians in the Baltic republics were immediately deprived of their citizenship upon the collapse of the Soviet Union. In many cases, they'd lived there for several generations but found themselves disenfranchised simply because of their ethnicity. And similar kinds of pressure, forced exodus on Russians in Central Asia. Then there's the Georgian example. Russians live with this on a daily basis. Many have relatives who've had to flee some of these regions, again, discriminated against solely for their ethnicity. They don't like being blamed for things that Stalin did, 40, 50 years ago. They find that this, you Russians did this, you did that. They can acknowledge the horrible treatment of Ukrainians by Stalin, or the illegal annexation of the Baltic republics. But they didn't do that, and yet they're the targets of the strong anti-Russian sentiment on the part of these smaller nations all around the former Soviet Union. So they've suffered economically, a lot of discrimination, things that are very often, almost always ignored in the West. And we tend to think, well, you're Russians, you're the imperialists, this was your empire. How can you be complaining now? How can you be playing the victim? The fact is, it was the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, and especially its leadership under Joseph Stalin, that did all these horrible things, not ordinary Russians, who suffered as much as ordinary Ukrainians or ordinary Latvians and Estonians. They feel that for, 20 years, the world has forgotten that they were victims too, and instead is blaming them as an entire people for the sins of various czars or commissars.
So to the question of Putin's criminality, if you will, I mean, a lot of people think that he's basically a thug and a thief, and that this is personal, that he sees his puppet go under. I spoke yesterday with Angela Stent, who's been at the highest levels of U.S. government Russian policy for quite a long time. She was with Putin at the time of Gaddafi's fall, and she said, he was quite freaked out about what happened to Gaddafi. But
I think he was freaked out by what happened to Gaddafi, mainly because it was an example of, again, the NATO alliance.
Sure,
remember,
sure.
The resolutions that empowered the military action there were only supposed to be defending the opposition, mm-hmm. but they were quickly used as a tool for regime change. That's what scares him, not any personal affinity for Gaddafi or any personal like for other corrupt dictators. Sure, he's corrupt. So was Yanukovych. But guess what? Everyone's hero and hope for future Ukrainian president, Yulia Tymoshenko, right. was a corrupt oligarch as well.
Oh.
She has foreign bank accounts.
Sure.
She has palatial homes. when she was running the corporation that imported natural gas from Russia under a previous prime minister, she became fabulously wealthy. She was once known as the gas princess.
Right.
There are no absolute heroes and absolute villains here. And everybody in Russian politics and everyone in Ukrainian politics is significantly corrupt. I don't mean everyone in the country. There are brave opposition fighters. There are anti-corruption campaigners. But I mean people at high levels of power. We went through this once with the Orange Revolution, right? It's almost replaying. When back in 2004, 2005, an older, corrupt, pro-Russian Ukrainian government was swept out by people power. And the pro-Western liberals came in. And that was President Yushchenko and his prime minister, Yulia Tymoshenko. And they botched things up marvelously. That's the reason that the Ukrainians voted Yanukovych back in, because the liberals were just as corrupt and just as incompetent. So I don't see affinity for some other guy who has palatial homes or who skims off the top has anything to do with this. Top leaders in all these countries are absolutely practical and cynical about that.
And also, I think just in closing, in terms of the pot calling kettle black, ugly nationalism is just as alive and well in Russia as it is in Ukraine. I mean, the Cossacks who are whipping pro-Ukrainian protesters in Crimea, they're just as anti-Semitic as Svoboda, right?
Yeah, but they're not in power. And now Svoboda has, as I said,
that's
70
true.
Key positions in the new government, and that's what makes it different.
Well,
and bizarrely, as you say in closing, sometimes we have to step back and look at this whole spectrum of politics and realize we could do a lot worse than Putin. In other words, there are far-right forces. There are equivalents of the extreme, skinhead, violent, xenophobic, and anti-Semitic Russian nationalism that are just another variant of Svoboda in Ukraine. But they're not in power. And, Putin he does play on nationalism for his own domestic popularity, but at the same time, he keeps even worse forces out of power. It's a strange position. I don't like to be praising Putin, but we could do even worse. Russia has such deep problems and so many angry and dispossessed people who would be willing to back, again, just as odious a right-wing nationalist figure as some of those that we see in Ukraine right now.
Well, Robert English, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert English, who's a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California, who studies Russia, the former USSR, and Eastern Europe, and formerly worked as a policy analyst for the United States Department of Defense and the Committee for National Security. He's currently working on a study entitled Our Serbian Brethren, History, Myth, and the Politics of Russian National Identity. And he has an article at the Los Angeles Times, Ukraine's Threat from Within, Neo-Fascists Are as Much a Menace to Ukraine as Putin's Actions in Crimea. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the escalating street battles and demonstrations in Venezuela.